I'm Vivian Goldman. We're at Goldeneye and we're top form on the Top Form podcast. I know you're going to enjoy it.
This is season 3 of the Top Form podcast. My name is Donovan Watkins, as you know, and we're kicking off the episode different this time. Usually we have a reggae artist, a hip-hop artist, talk about something like that, but this time we're talking to the legendary Vivian Goldman. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome her. Give me a resounding round of applause.
Hello, everybody. Very excited to be here with you, Donovan.
Vivian Goldman, yeah, how are you doing?
We are very happy to be here.
I'm really happy you obliged us some minutes of your time to talk about music, life, fun, all that you've done in the world. So before we get into the music part, tell us your origin. Where are you from?
I'm from London. I'm first generation there. You were asking me about it, so I know you're interested. I was am a child of refugees, which I think has really informed my outlook and my work all along, you know. And my parents escaped from Nazi Germany, you know, literally, actually, my father escaped from police headquarters in Berlin. And that's how come I came to be a Londoner. And that's probably, you know, if I'd been somehow an Australian instead, because at that time people scattered everywhere, and I have cousins I'm just finding in Australia, you know, who when they were displaced people, they had to go somewhere and they wound up there, I maybe would not be sitting here with you now. But instead I was in London, I was part of the punky reggae party in the 70s, that was such a formative movement, and Jamaica became part of my life, and I'm sitting with you as we speak.
Do you find that there are any similarities between your upbringing and what you came to find in Jamaica?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. In my book that I would be flashing to you, but I haven't got it, which is also now an audio book read by me, The Book of Exodus, The Making and Meaning of Bob Marley and the Wailers Album of the Century, because I worked for a long time with Bob Marley in that period in which he was a, you know, almost killed and so on, and did the Exodus album. And in that book, I had a chance to really explore some of the connections, and the connections are very deep and manifest in all sorts of ways. Not only that both Rastas and Jews do follow dietary codes that are actually very similar, you know. You know, many connections, and Jamaica being such a diasporic people whose impact has spread everywhere. Let's face it, Jews are not that dissimilar in that sense. And, you know, people who've survived oppression, you know, maybe it's not the time to look at contemporary politics in this reggae-oriented podcast, you know, but Bob Marley understood about Zion, you know, and so do I, you know.
Talk to us a little bit more about your time with Bob Marley. How did that come about? How did you meet him? And what was that experience like?
So formative, so beautiful in retrospect. And I knew it was beautiful at the time, too. And I was lucky to be, you know, the first woman in my family to go to university and come out at a sort of time with a somewhat of a feeling of expansion amidst the chaos, you know, of post-colonialism and post-war, you know what I mean? But women were starting to have more of an entree, so I was able to become, it's rather a quaint a music journalist.
What years were this?
That we're talking like the mid-70s, mid-1970s, and of course at that time, as you'll know, Bob Marley and the Wailers were hitting a certain stride. They always had a stride, but they were getting into a slightly different stride. You know, Bob had been living in London and so on. You know, he lived in just sort of places around West London that are not recorded. Now they have a plaque for him in the West End, where he stayed when he was, you know, bigger. But yeah, he told me London was his second home. Anyway,
How did you meet him?
What happened was that I got a job. I'd been a student, and like all hip music students, I worshipped Bob Marley and the Wailers. Everybody in England did. These were from the early albums like Catch a Fire, the early albums to be released in a big way with a lot of push in the UK. So then somehow, fate or just, say what you will, led me to getting this job where I had the responsibility to do the PR for Bob, the Wailers, Burning Spear, Aswad, and Steel Pulse. That's a nice job, right?
It is.
But at the time, they weren't so well known. Bob wasn't so well known. The others were just starting. So it was fabulous for me, and it probably changed the course of my life, because I started off writing the press releases that helped sell Bob at the time when a lot of people at Island Records, founded by Chris Blackwell, who's at place Goldeneye was sitting at, you know, everybody was very keen to make that cultural shift which Bob represented happen. And he was such a new voice, such a necessary voice. He so galvanized, like, the youth of England. Obviously, he gave a huge identity for black youth or diasporic youth, but also very much so, as you see me sitting here, for all sorts, because Bob was like that, you know. And it was an amazing, like, setting a high bar for my life to have him as a mentor.
When you met him, like, tell me the first word Bob said to you, can remember. First thing he said, first day you met him.
Well, it was really a weird one, actually. As it happens, if you want me to tell the truth, which presumably you do, but what happened was, I was meant to go and pick Bob and the Wailers up at the airport for the tour, though, where they played the Lyceum and all that, which really broke them in the UK before the US. And that night, my father died. So I didn't go and pick them up. And, you know, I sat actually the Jewish equivalent of nine nights, which is a week of mourning called sitting shiva. So I didn't get to be groovy, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to be there with Bob and the group, and, you know, but no, it wasn't like that. I was in a state of more meditation. And then when I finally met him, having been his press officer and built the whole campaign and then not been there, I said to him, you know, to be honest, sorry, I haven't been there like I was would normally have been, but in fact, my father just died, and I expected some like sympathetic noise, but in fact he was just like, oh, okay. And he was sort of, because he doesn't want to talk about death because he's a Rasta, and that's really, really what it was. It was one of my first lessons in slipping into it, you know, like all those songs by Peter Tosh, Rasta No Go, A Burial, it's a Rasta thing. So, but then he went on to really be a mentor to me, and you know, the lessons I learned from him still guide me.
So what were the first words?
Oh yeah, he was gruff, you know. He was like, oh, okay, your father just died. He didn't say, oh God, I'm terribly sorry, let me get you a Kleenex. He was just, okay, soldier, let's get on with it. I hear you,
right,
it's life, we move on. I'm a Rasta, I don't really deal with death. That is the old school way. You might not even know about that.
No, I definitely
that
understand.
That was the orthodoxy of the time.
So your life, from what period to what period did you work directly with Bob Marley?
Well, even when I wasn't, the thing is, you know, I did his PR first, but then I became a journalist accompanying him a lot. Then at a certain point, I was always in touch with him somewhat till the end. And yeah, so from when I left university till he left us.
Which university you attended?
I'm a proud product of Warwick University. No, Warwick University, actually, it still remains a good university.
What did you study?
I studied English and American literature, but I also started the Film Society with some friends of mine, like Steve Jenkins, who later went on to be a big shot at the British Film Institute. Yeah.
So what made you make the switch from wanting to being literature to reggae music?
Well, it's life for a start. Where I lived in West London, well, you see, my job led me there. My father was a musician. We were musical at home. I'm a musical person. I then became a musician later, you know, and I'm now doing music again. But I guess I was just a musical type. But to be honest, at that time, the world was so different. I was an artistic person. I was always a writer. I actually wanted to go into the film business, but there literally wasn't one, let alone there wasn't one for a woman or there wasn't one for a black person. There wasn't one in England at that time. So given that, I looked around, and this is always a good tip, viewer, if you're trying to work out what am I going to do next, you know, it's that thing of really work out what is your skill set, what are you good at, like write it down in order of how good you are at them, and then think about where does that intersect with the marketplace. End result, I became a quaint old job description, because it barely exists now, a music journalist. I'm exaggerating a little for effect, but it's much reduced as a career. But, you know, I sometimes teach how to do it, and the fact is, beleaguered as it may be, there's so much music now. People do still like to have some authoritative voices that they trust. I thought the whole business was just gone for a minute, to be honest, but then I learned that no, people still love music and they still want to learn more about their music. So journalism. But at the time it was a gig. At the time there was like half a dozen music papers paying by the word. So if you stayed up all night and you wrote 3,000 words, you were sweet.
What's the key to being a good music journalist?
Oh, there's quite a few levels. Obviously, you want to have good musical appreciation. You know, you have to have something to say. You have to respond to the music. You have to have an analysis. For that, it helps to have a context. The thing is, when I started writing about music, when the music press was arguably at its height as such, you know, there was not that much music, because the music business was still young. But now there's a flood of music and people aren't getting paid as much always to monitor it. You see what I mean? When you used to get whatever. You see what I mean? So,
what was that? What was that pay like then versus now?
Oh. Okay. Am I talking to the future music journalists of tomorrow? Because the thing is, I've learned, like I said, at one point I almost gave up. But even though I was teaching it, I felt like I was sending the students into battle, you know. Because there's so many things you can do, like what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's much freer. But the thing is, how do you get paid? It was simpler for me. I studied the music. I soon became an expert. It had not been going for very long, and I had a good ear, and I understood the music. But then I could interpret the music, and then I could write. I've been writing. You know, we've been trying to meet people. It's been very hard. He's given me space because I'm trying to write this big project about...
And you've been super
Nigerian
busy.
Yeah, writing, you see. But that's... I wonder how many people who are starting out now watching the program will have the access that was created by the fact that I got paid. I knew 2 weeks I'd have my little check. It was never much. You did it really for the love, but also you had a great life, you know.
So if somebody wants to become a music journalist today,
yes,
what do they do? First thing.
See, it's a complete, well, I would say, I keep coming back.
Do they go
back
to school? Do they teach themselves?
Okay. I do professor, teach music journalism. I teach at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music, as an adjunct, mainly once a year. And I sometimes have spoken about music journalism in that context, but I taught music journalism at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I felt I was sending students into the fray. Yes, it's not so simple like back in the day. Oh, Edison, oh, I heard a great band. Oh, really, Vivian? Oh, go and write, 2,000 words about them and deliver by such and such a time. Boom, off I go, get your check, no worries. Now, it's the same as being an artist. All arts are more beleaguered in a sense. You can make it, but you have to think differently. You actually have to be more of a hustler. It helps if you're a hustler in a positive way. You want to have your vision and you want to be able to build your team. And I would wager that that is not unlike how you have developed your career. Whereas I just went, it was a big publishing company. They had a number of magazines. They had a number of music papers that were rivals. They had like, and where I was at first, they had Record Mirror and Sounds, for example. And I made Sounds like when I was features editor there in the punky reggae paper, at the time. But it's a different landscape now. You've got to get out there, you've got to be imaginative, you've got to hustle, you've got to build your community. I think that one thing that's going on now is that people do still enjoy the live experience. Do you find that?
They do. But I'm still interested
in
the differences between what you had and what's going on now. Shaggy recently said mm-hmm. at the Jamaica Music Conference mm-hmm. that the fact that he is light-skinned has helped him on the international scene.
Wow.
Do you think Bob Marley...
That's what they used to say about Bob Marley all the time. Well, a number of factors. There were other light-skinned people. He really was an incredible performer and entertainer and singer, songwriter. Maybe it didn't hurt. We know the world we live in, but what made him Bob Marley wasn't that he was light-skinned.
So do you think...
I mean, what made him Bob Marley, I mean, having said that, so everybody jumps on every word, don't use that without me making it clearer. Obviously, it was part of what made him who he was. All I'm saying was I don't think we can just, oh, Bob, he's got light skin. Oh, naturally, he was that big. There are a number of factors at play, and they, arguably some of the audience found him more accessible, looking a bit more like them in the mass audience. That's possible. But that alone wouldn't have done it. You had to have that. You remember when I was talking about that skill set, that toolbox of skills that Bob Marley had? And I have to say, and this is not to diminish any of the other great artists who didn't get their due, you see, which is why people get upset because so much emphasis was put on Bob. I have to say, Bob didn't want that. But Bob, if you were to ask me, what is the one thing you learnt from Bob Marley, it's really like tenacity, like professionalism, turn up on time. The thing that we always used to say about Bob, like jokingly, affectionately in the crew, was first on the bus, last in the studio. Boom, that's Bob. He was a leader, mm-hmm. and he knew that to be a leader, you have to lead by example. You have to know what you're doing. I remember he once said to me, this is my work, and I know it inside out. So I often say, teaching and talking to people, I always try to talk. I said I would talk to you. I didn't know who you were. He said, can I talk? I said, sure, But I keep coming back to this thing. A lot of people say that the generation coming up right now, there's a lot of ADD, too much fragmented in the internet, and sense of entitlement. Those are the criticisms you often hear. And then people come to me and ask me, how do I make certain things happen? I often think to myself and I say to them, three little words, do the work, do the work. Get down and get dirty and do the work. You
do
might be
work.
Crying, okay? Because yeah. It's so painful, but you do the work.
Do the work. So there's a saying in Jamaica among a lot of artists that the music is being exploited by people from outside Jamaica and Jamaicans are not getting their just due from the music. What do you say about people who are advocating for having a more purist nature for the music and have more
purist.
Jamaicans benefit? And do you think Jamaicans benefit?
Oh, that's a different thing from purists. This is such a complex area, mm-hmm. which I've lectured a fair amount and written about, for example, in Freeze magazine. And it's, these days, they call it cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. I've lectured on it, sometimes quite controversially, because obviously what you're saying is not new. You know, when they gave a blues artist a pink Cadillac instead of a royalty, it wasn't much different. The music business has always been a very corrupt and exploitative one. And obviously the early roots of the Jamaican music industry are pretty tragic. At that, you know, in terms of what the artists got, and I don't know whether you're aware, but in downtown Kingston, they probably do still have the Veteran Reggae Performers Association. It would be nice if you could do something to help them. You know, in lieu of having one of those big American museums, they are trying to, they were, and I'm sure they still are, I haven't been there for a while, you know, gathering support for the many reggae artists who we see suffering in their old age, given that the whole industry is a mess anyway.
Yeah.
It's not like you can say, gosh, you know. And, I mean, now is such a different time. All those old paradigms are being shaken up, because of the access we have to equipment, the access we have to the internet. Now, as to your original question with cultural appropriation, we could talk a very long time about this. It's enormously complex, and honestly, we could sit down and do a whole separate hour on it, but we're not going to. So there's a couple of little thoughts, you know. I would like to tell you about something that happened long, long ago when I was working. I still work a lot, quite a lot, with Sly and Robbie. They're my good friends. Sly and Robbie, the original Glimmer Twin, like rhythm section, of the famous Taxi label. And we were friends like all our lives, really, since we were young adults. And I remember saying to him at the time, when the police came out with Roxanne, I was like, oh my God, this is appalling. How can they be ripping off your rhythms like this? And he was saying, are you kidding? This is the greatest thing. It's developing a taste for what we do, and it's developing a market. And from this, there will be a knock-on effect that we will get work. Was he wrong? I don't think so. You know, he's had a career, you know. The police were a rock phenomenon. I'm saying literally, look where we're at in history, you know. I do tend to look at things in terms of the historical process, because frankly, otherwise you can go insane, you know. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
And history, we sometimes forget that history does move on. When I first came to Jamaica, there was only Earl Chin doing a TV reggae show in New York, the Rockers TV show. Bob Marley gave him the equipment to do that because he was so annoyed that black people didn't get a chance in the media. So, you know, he came up to him have I got his name right? Wayne, what the fuck was his name?
He said Earl Chin?
Earl Chin, no, it is Earl Chin, I'm pretty sure. Otherwise, we'll have to double check that. But he came to Bob with this idea as an aspiring Caribbean expat in New York. And Bob said, hey, I can make it happen, let's do it. And that was in the early days of cable TV. And that was the first time that the individual had had access to the medium, you know?
What were some of...
Earl Chin and his long-running cable TV show Rockers, some of which...
Bob Marley gave him the equipment.
Yes.
Do you encourage artists to become entrepreneurs? You spoke about being a hustler for being a music journalist.
At the same time, you have to know your... The first thing I said was know your skills. Know your skills. Know your skill set. And sometimes you do have to flex and test those skills. There's no doubt about it, to maybe refine what you're good at if you don't always know. Mm-hmm. But then it's really better to... To me, it's like almost an equation. You know, you look at the marketplace, what's working. Don't look at me. I've just managed to get through. You know, I'm not a wealthy person, far from, you know, I'm just a freelance you know, cultural worker. That's how I see myself ultimately, a freelance cultural worker, working in different fields. You know, as you know, I worked TV for a long time, writing, radio, now podcasts. I'm doing a podcast with Sonos around my book, Revenge of the She-Punks. So I work with media, primarily writing, but not exclusively. And I'm also a musician, and I am also now an educator, and have been consistently since 05. So if you can work out what your skill set is and just be open, and it's like the old adage, you know, be ready for any opportunity. But if you can work out where it is you would feel happy and what you're really best at, because I've shared some things along the way, things I still sometimes do sometimes for people, you know, because I saw other people who were as good as me or even better, and I try to keep it down to what I can do really well. What do I have to offer? And where does it intersect with the marketplace so that I can somehow keep going? Because we want to be able to keep going, don't we?
Yeah. Chris Blackwell, tell us about the relationship you have with him.
Well, you know, through him, I'm sitting here on his property, as it happens, where actually I have a long attachment to Goldeneye, as did Bob Marley, you know. I was lucky coming up at that time when even political legislation was going through that made things available to women that had never been available before. Like when I was actually able to buy a house as a woman, and my big sister wouldn't have been able to buy a house as a woman. You had to be signed for by a husband or father.
In
the
England?
UK, yeah. In the UK, yes. And you know, sometimes because things are so challenging now, things are so hard, and it's so easy to fall into a depression. And let's be honest, we've seen suicide rates rocket among young people and middle-aged men, you know, because it really is an extremely challenging time, given that we are not technically, officially in an actual state of world war, right? We're not. Given that, between the number of areas in which we're squeezed, you know, it can be easy to just to sort of want to give up and lose faith. You know, I can't remember quite how we got into this, but we go back to what Bob Marley taught me, I think, which is tenacity. One thing I found by my close study of the Exodus album, not only was I there at the recording sessions, I was with Bob while he was writing the song Guiltiness, which was unforgettable. I mean, I'm sure he spent ages. It was just one moment that I was with him in a long process of him working on the song, obviously, you know. So, but in my very close study of it, in which I actually listened almost only to the Exodus album for like over 2 years, kept on finding new meaning and nuance in it, new inspiration. I realized how incredibly kind and generous he was as an artist because of what he did with Exodus, which is that he was absolutely, brutally unflinching in his regard of how evil people are to one another. I realized in this close study of this one album how generous Bob really was, because through the darkness, you know, you start off with, you know, it's as if you really go through the valley of darkness on that record with tracks like Guiltiness and Heathen. And yet he does lead us into the light, into happiness. Like, as I said in the book, I seem to remember the sunlit uplands of one love, you know. So he releases us, you know, so it's all been very, you know, I feel very glad that I've been able to spend time with the thoughts and music of this man. You know, we're so disillusioned with almost everyone, aren't we? Who hasn't let us down at this point? Of course, you know, Bob did leave us young. How would he have handled Zimbabwe and all that, and the changes in perception of Robert Mugabe as the man who wrote that stirring anthem, Zimbabwe? But to return to Chris Blackwell, you were asking me about my connection with him. Yeah, it was just, you know, call it destiny, call it karma, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, or Jah. You know, I wound up working closely with him for just an intense, I believe it was 7 months. And that led to me sitting here with you now. Because I felt the music and I was able to do an effective job, and he appreciated that. I remember when I left, when I resigned to become a full-time writer, he said something like, oh, you might be even more useful to me on the outside, because he knew I was really, really into the music. And here I still am.
The podcast is called Top Form Podcast.
Oh, Top Form.
So do you consider yourself a top performer?
I think I have, I think I'm top form within my niche. And I think maybe it's up to you to define that niche.
This is the second to last segment. And this is the speed segment, right? You're just going to give me the first word that comes to the top of your head.
Oh, paging Dr. Freud.
Bob Marley.
Rastaman Vibration.
Music.
Food of life and love.
What does love mean?
It's a many splendid thing.
Jamaica.
My second home.
First home.
Ooh, I suppose I'm a little bit bi-homal, because I guess it's London and New York. I've sort of lived, and then I had a great time in Paris, but I guess I'm a London, New Yorker.
First food, favorite food, sorry.
Oh God, probably at the end of the day, chicken soup, the way mother used to make and the way I still do. But actually, Jamaica is my second home, so sometimes I do add a bell pepper.
Favorite city?
Oh, that's too rough. Pass.
And what's your idea of God?
Well, I have to say, honestly, I was raised Orthodox Jewish. I was raised Orthodox Jewish, and that's always a deep part of me. But I have to say Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. I have to say it, really. It's been helped me a lot, everybody. I've never actually said that on camera before, but since you ask.
Tell us about, this is the final segment, tell us about dub music. Oh. What does that mean to you?
You see, it's interesting. When I was teaching a course on Jamaican music at NYU, or a Bob Marley course, because I teach those courses, and I was teaching about dub, and when I first taught it, which was years ago, a friend of mine who's a dub dread in New York, Haitian person, Ras Kush, he came in and he demonstrated with Dex, because it's a music department and they had it like that, or maybe he even brought equipment in, and it was great, you know. But then when I was looking for somebody like a dub DJ, you know what, thin on the ground in New York, and I found this producer who came in. He said, oh, I know how to do dub. And then he gave me a lift home to Queens, and he said, you know what, I haven't thought about dub for years. And I realized that dub was such a formative thing for certain people at a certain time. It reflected so many things. It reflected the ecology, because it reflected the fluctuations in the oil business, because everybody was recycling. Vinyl was precious. You had a shed out the back, you know, with people pressing these records. Incidentally, pressing records has only recently returned to Jamaica at the Tuff Gong Studios. For a while, you could not press records in Jamaica. Dub represented a shattering of all your expectations and the possibility of regrowth in a new way and finding a new beauty. And when you were living through a time when, rather like today, there's an incredible sense of uncertainty around, you know. Dub, with its sort of postmodern use of space and the way it expects everything to implode and shift at a moment's notice, but it can still have integrity and still be beautiful, had a lot of meaning and gave a lot of us hope in a way that was embedded in, of course, some of the greatest music ever. Made in Jamaica.
Made in Jamaica. Great way to end. Vivian Goldman, journalist, music journalist, Jamaican lover, and all-time all-star writer. Thank you so much, Vivian Goldman.
It's been really a pleasure. But I'd like to add and have you drop in some connection. Last time, I do mention this location, Goldeneye, in my new award-winning book, Revenge of the She-Punks, because I interviewed Grace Jones. As you know, she's a fantastic Jamaican artist. I mean, I've never seen an artist really greater than Grace Jones out of anybody, and anybody out of all the artists would have to give her that, you know. And I was very, very lucky to be here working actually with a new reggae label, a new Jamaican reggae label.
Island?
No, not Island. That is a veteran, long established label. But I was here working with Trojan Jamaica.
Oh, that's lately. Oh,
yes.
Okay.
So lately, I was here working with Zach Starkey and Shush Liguz, the founders of Trojan Jamaica. We were lucky enough to be invited for dinner here at Goldeneye, and who should be there but Grace Jones, who I'd also worked with really at the start of her career, but I hadn't seen her for a while, but she's so remarkable. And we just sat on the beach and had this great reasoning. And it was beautiful to see her at this point, just really enjoying being Jamaican, you know? She's been around the world, she's been a superstar, runway model, actress in action movies. You know, you can't touch Grace. And yet, Jamaica always remained where she felt at her peak, I suppose.